You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. We're continuing our series on scaling AI. Don't count us out yet, but we're taking a detour tonight to talk about Venezuela and our very long history there. Now, if you walk along the streets of Washington, just a block from the National Mall and less than a block from the Federal Reserve, and somewhere slightly west of the Organization of American States, you'll come across a regal statue of a man on horseback. His right arm extends upward, holding a battle sword ready, his exposed head of curly hair and his thick beard signaling youth, strength, and fearlessness against an unseen armed opponent. As your eyes move downward to the inscriptions on the wide marble and bronze pedestal supporting the Western Hemisphere's largest equine statue, you'll see the words Simón Bolívar, Liberator of the Americas. He lived from 1783 to 1830. What you don't see is at the age of 37, Bolívar died penniless in Colombia of an unknown respiratory illness, then thought to be one of the usual suspects, tuberculosis, but now believed to be arsenic poisoning caused by natural elements that bubbled to the surface of groundwater in Venezuela, the very country Bolívar liberated from the Kingdom of Spain. Bolívar's rebellion didn't just free Venezuela from the grip of Spain, but he also liberated the entirety of Gran Colombia, then comprised of Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Panama. The statue of Bolívar, though, was given to the United States in 1955 by the president of Venezuela, and the part where it sits was dedicated in 1959. Now, while the statue of Bolívar is one of many statues of Latin American national figures, such as Benito Juárez, the first indigenous president of Mexico, General José de San Martín, the man who helped Argentina free itself of Spanish rule before dying in exile in France, and José Gervasio Artigas, who helped liberate Uruguay with his gauchos, those tea-swilling cowboys whose fitness against the Spaniards may have derived from their own lineage as indigenous and European. Undone by his own insistence on a decentralized government, Artigas died in near obscurity in Asunción, Paraguay, after living to the age of 87. By 2025, the country of Venezuela was under the rule of Nicolas Maduro, a Chavista, who was either hand-selected by the late Hugo Chavez and installed against the popular will of everyday Venezuelans, or was duly elected by ardent followers, 90+% of whom voted for him in a miracle of statistical anomaly. Tonight, to talk about our long diplomatic and often undiplomatic relationship with Venezuela is Brian Egan, a partner at Skadden Arps, who has served as the State Department's legal advisor and counsel to the U.S. Department of Treasury and former Deputy White House counsel, and on and on and on. Hello, Brian. I'm glad you're here.
Thanks, Lisa. It's great to be here.
Give us a sense of the United States' relationship with Venezuela over the centuries.
Well, as you said, we have a relationship with Venezuela that goes back to really the beginning of the United States, where we and Venezuela both saw ourselves as under the power of European colonists who should be ejected. So if you look back to the early 1800s, Americans participated in an effort to remove the Spanish colonial powers. It was unsuccessful. Venezuela eventually got its independence in 1835. The U.S. was one of the first countries to recognize the new government of Venezuela, and we have been close, either as friends or as adversaries, really ever since. And I think over the last 120 years, the relationship has really been involved and revolved around oil, beginning in the early 20th century up until now. U.S. oil, U.S. oil companies, U.S. oil needs have really driven U.S. policy towards Venezuela.
And my understanding from looking at just a couple of articles in the Wall Street Journal recently is they also have an enormous amount of gold, copper, high BTU coal, and other minerals that would probably be important to us as we're moving forward in an AI-dominated, potentially quantum-dominated world. You know, we may have this relationship, but have we had any agreements with Venezuela over these years?
We actually have a number of agreements that remain in force to this day. Treaties governing everything from maritime boundaries to taxation to trade and investment to law enforcement cooperation, really the full gamut of treaties that one might expect the United States to have in place with an ally that's not a defense ally, but a country that has been close to the United States for a long time.
It's interesting you say that because I didn't think that we had an extradition treaty with Venezuela, and it's become a popular place for people to flee who want to avoid prosecution in the United States. But to hear that there's law enforcement cooperation is an interesting fact.
Well, and it's, as you know, Elisa, it's one thing to have a treaty on things like mutual legal assistance and extradition. It's another thing to actually be able to use those tools in a law enforcement capacity. So I'd be shocked if the law enforcement treaties in particular have been used at all over the last 30 years.
But the idea is there, right?
But yeah, exactly.
Somebody put pen to paper and had a conversation. So that's sort of the nature of our relationship with them is shifting all the time, centered on these various sort of natural resources. But I guess another question might be, what is Venezuela's relationship with the international bodies like the United Nations? And then there are dozens of others, even though I understand that we've left a lot of those, a lot of core international bodies remain and we remain participants.
Yeah, that's right. Venezuela has been, is a member of the United Nations. It is subject to ongoing monitoring by the UN Human Rights Committee. A fact-finding mission has been in place since 2019 that periodically releases reports that are very critical of the Venezuelan government, most recently in December. And that commission has gone on, including to this day. Venezuela has been a party to cases before the International Court of Justice. The most famous one in recent days is a border dispute between Venezuela and Guyana, which really relates to oil and mineral resources underseas, where the ICJ has essentially sided with Guyana so far. The case is ongoing. So they're a participant in international bodies. They have not been free from criticism by those bodies, particularly in recent days.
There are other international organizations that are sort of not features of post-Second World War efforts at global communication. But there's also the OPEC. And I'm wondering what role it's played in Venezuelan politics, since Venezuela is one of the 12 member nations comprising OPEC, which of course stands for the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, an organization that includes countries like Iran and Gabon.
Yeah, that's right. So Venezuela has been part of OPEC since the founding of OPEC in, I think it was 1960. And in its heyday, Venezuela was a very influential member of OPEC, looking back in the 70s to the early 90s. Because Venezuela's oil production has gone down over the last 30 years, and that's partly a factor of the nature of the crude oil available in Venezuela, which is heavy crude, very hard to get out of the ground, really only makes sense to pump it when oil prices are high. It's partly due to the deterioration of the oil sector in Venezuela. For other reasons, it's partly due to U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. But Venezuela's influence in OPEC has really gone down over the last few decades because it just doesn't produce as much oil. And that's, of course, what this alliance is all about, is controlling supply and pricing of oil. My sense is that OPEC hasn't played a huge role in domestic Venezuelan politics over the last 20, 30 years, at least, because of that.
Let's talk about what's been happening recently, because it's been dramatic. And for a lot of us, it seemed like a big shift. And I will be candid that I don't have all the facts on this. I know what I read in the paper. We have blown up a number of boats. We've attacked a number of boats that allegedly came from Venezuela and were carrying at least drugs. There was some public reporting or claims about possible WMDs. Is there any domestic or international law that governs where a boat is carrying contraband to the shores of the United States? We're entitled to take some sort of kinetic action. And if there isn't, what are we entitled to do? I guess some of that must appear. Is it under Title 48?
So start with like the law enforcement. It's not unusual for the United States and the United States Coast Guard in particular to take action in a counter-narcotics law enforcement capacity in waters that are not attached to a particular country, the high seas, as some people say. The U.S. has had domestic legal authorities in place, somewhat controversially, but a statute for 40 years, the Maritime Drug Law Enforcement Act, which basically authorizes as a U.S. legal matter, the U.S. Coast Guard to interdict ships on the high seas that are not affiliated with any particular country, what some people call stateless ships, for drug-related offenses, even if those drug-related offenses have no direct connection to the United States. So a pretty strong extraterritorial law enforcement authority that has been blessed by the U.S. Congress for the last 40 years. And then on the international law side, a treaty has been in place, again, for about 40 years, the UN Convention Against Illicit Trafficking in Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances. Almost every member of the UN is a party to this treaty, to include the United States, Venezuela, Russia, Cuba, you name it. And this treaty requires member states to cooperate with each other on, among other things, law enforcement operations designed to interdict and stop illicit narcotic activity in international waters. So there's a pretty, as these things go, mature law enforcement framework for cooperation and interdiction actions on the high seas. There's also the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea and other things that govern how state countries can operate in international waters. Now, none of these laws or treaties contemplate what you said, Elise, a kinetic action on the high seas. I suppose if there was a law enforcement action that was undertaken pursuant to these laws and a U.S. Coast Guard member was in danger, you know, he or she would have the right to defend themselves as part of that operation. But that's, of course, not what we're talking about here. We're talking about kinetic strikes from the United States directed at ships, not as an interdiction, but really to destroy the ships with casualties in mind. None of these laws authorize or govern those circumstances. You really have to look to just more traditional laws governing the use of force by one country, either against another country or in the high seas. And that's a different set of issues that really doesn't have anything to do with the law enforcement activity that has been driven U.S. drug operations for the most part over the last several decades.
You mentioned it's part six, the UN convention that addresses activities occurring upon the high seas. I feel that there was one other little element of this, which is in the situation where there is a flag upon a vessel. And I don't want to get into sort of the nonsense that ensues with flagging a vessel, because you can get Poland, a landlocked country, to give you a flag, if I'm not mistaken. And then if they would consent to the boarding of that vessel, then we could undertake a boarding in that situation.
That's right. That's what the U.S. statute that we talked about, the Maritime Drug Law Enforcement Act, kind of talks about. The Coast Guard should seek consent, which they do, from the country that has flagged the vessel. There are rules, including in international law, about when a country that is the flagged vessel's flagged country, what they should and shouldn't and mustn't do in terms of providing consent and cooperating with other countries. But there's a whole other set of rules around vessels that don't have a home country, so-called stateless vessels. And that's what this U.S. law says. The United States forces are authorized to interdict stateless vessels for counter-narcotics purposes.
And in this case, I guess the videos would suggest that some of these are what are colloquially known as go-fast vessels. They're not enormous container ship vessels, as you might imagine, you know, coming into the port of Baltimore or any of the larger port areas. Those are generally, I guess, used to transport from a larger vessel directly to shore. Let's go on and talk about treaties, agreements, back channels, or other diplomatic relations that we're now hearing apparently were somewhat ongoing with Venezuela before Maduro was captured by U.S. forces, to include some recent reporting that the Vatican was pretty heavily involved in trying to negotiate this. Can you talk a bit about that? Can you describe the distinction, sort of the layers of things, sort of treaties, agreements versus, say, back channels or diplomatic relations, and how diplomatic relations versus back channels might be different?
Yeah, and just to be clear, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of the communications that may have gone on between our government and various folks in Venezuela over the last several months. It's certainly not unusual, though, for there to be official communications between the U.S. government and another government, including an adversary government, and unofficial or non-public communications. And that, according to all public reports, seems to be exactly what's been going on here. So let's unpack that a little bit. On the official communication side, we've seen the United States and Venezuela under President Trump and Nicolas Maduro actually cooperate on one of the main Trump administration objectives, which has been to expel Venezuelan immigrants from the United States and to send them back to Venezuela. Our government and Venezuela have entered into agreements governing these operations. As you can imagine, they're pretty technically complicated, involving flights, involving other transportation of people back and forth. There have been adjustments to U.S. sanctions that have been negotiated with the Venezuelan, with the Maduro regime, to allow for these transportation activities to take place. And so that has led to, actually, my impression, a fair amount of communications between U.S. law enforcement, military, political officials, and their counterparts in Venezuela. On the unofficial side, we're hearing a couple of pretty interesting, it seems to be credible, things about what has happened in the lead up to the Maduro operation that we'll talk about in a moment. For the first one, Elisa, is the one that you mentioned, which is the Vatican has actually publicly confirmed that it was playing a role before the capture operation, Operation Absolute Resolve, to find a place that President Maduro could essentially go in exile, to leave Venezuela and to avoid any activity like the one that we saw. And so what's been reported, and I think basically acknowledged by the Vatican, is as recently as Christmas, so a week or two before the U.S. military operation, the Vatican had been negotiating with more than one country to find a safe haven for President Maduro. It's not clear, to me at least, whether the failure of that was due to Maduro himself, due to any conditions that may have been placed on a third state. But obviously, those negotiations did not bear fruit in the long run. Now, the other unofficial communication that has been fairly widely reported, but disputed heavily by the current interim government in Venezuela, is communications between Delcy Rodriguez, who is the interim president of Venezuela, and various U.S. and Qatari officials about a post-Maduro Venezuelan government. Now, Ms. Rodriguez was second in command under Maduro, seen as a very loyal lieutenant to him. But what has been reported is that both she and other leading officials in the Maduro regime made it known to the United States that they would work with the U.S. government in a post-Maduro regime. They were not going to support or drive regime change in Venezuela, but if Maduro were to leave, they would be willing to work with the U.S. government. Now, again, President Rodriguez and others have flatly denied that these communications took place. Frankly, I can understand why, if that were the case. But what we are seeing, at least, is some amount of cooperation, which is somewhat remarkable because the government, other than Maduro, is the same government that has been at odds with the United States for almost 30 years at this point. That's another really interesting piece of back channel communications that at least reportedly went on before the capture.
Let's talk about how this might be different from another historic figure, which is Manuel Noriega, who was reportedly at some point a CIA source dating back to the 1960s, turned into a transshipment country, Panama did, and we captured Noriega. But how was this different, if it was?
The capture you're referring to took place in 1989 under the presidency of George Bush. And I listened to some former Bush administration officials talk about that capture and address this very question, Elisa. Of course, as a lawyer, I was focused on the legal issues, behind that operation, the Noriega operation in 1989, and what our government did earlier this month with Maduro. And all of the Bush administration officials who were interviewed, it was a University of Virginia podcast, cited back to an OLC opinion that had been published at the time explaining the U.S. legal rationale, which was that there were actually members of U.S. Armed Forces stationed in Colombia. There were other Americans of relatively sizable presence in Colombia. There had been an incident in which a service member had gotten into an argument with a member of the Colombian Armed Forces. The service member was actually killed.
Do you mean the Panamanian Armed Forces?
Excuse me. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Panama. I've got Colombia on the brain from Venezuela. Sorry. Yes. So the Panamanian Armed Forces under Noriega, one of our military members was killed. There were rumors reported in this OLC opinion that Noriega was planning additional actions against U.S. citizens in Panama. And so the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, concluded that the operations in Panama were lawful as a matter of both domestic and international law in order to defend the U.S. citizens and their interests who were present in Panama. Now, that justification, which was criticized back in the day at the, when it was put out, there's not even a facial justification for that in Venezuela today. There's, of course, no U.S. military presence. There's a very small U.S. expat presence, mostly in the oil industry, as I understand it. And the Trump administration has not suggested that they were capturing President Maduro to defend U.S. citizens in Venezuela. So much different set of facts, at least based on the stated legal justification.
Let's talk about what we did here. And I have to say, like it, hate it, it was just a demonstration of U.S. military excellence. First of all, talk a little bit about what happened here. And then second, do you see any legal authority for this yourself? I don't want to second guess this, individual was indicted clearly, but I would like to just concentrate on any legal authority for the military side of this thing.
So it's just a fascinating operation to learn more about. The military operation itself, which is called Operation Absolute Resolve, was under 3 hours. So it was a pretty short insertion extraction from Venezuela. What's been reported is, first of all, the U.S. military and intelligence community had been studying Maduro for months to the extent that, they knew where he was, they knew when he ate, when he slept, where he slept. They reportedly knew who his pets were. They really had tracked this man very, very carefully with an operation like this in mind. The operation began with a pretty overwhelming set of aerial bombardments, firepower directed at apparently defense-related resources in Venezuela. There were about 150 U.S. aircraft involved in the operation. President Trump most recently has talked about, I think he said, a secret discombobulator that was part of this effort that he was not authorized to say more about. But I think that, it's assumed that that was some sort of a cybersecurity type of weapon or activity that helped neutralize Venezuela's air defense forces and make it harder for them to detect the U.S. operation. There were, a number of casualties. It's been reported 200 casualties on the Venezuelan side, including several dozen members of the Cuban security forces who served as President Maduro's bodyguards, basically. And the special forces, U.S. special forces, they've entered Caracas. They knew where President Maduro's safe house was. He was there. They beat down steel doors to find him. He was allegedly trying to move his way back into a room that couldn't be penetrated. The door was broken down. He was grabbed and whisked away in U.S. helicopters and aircraft to stand trial in the United States. Pretty remarkable operation with a few U.S. casualties, but no U.S. fatalities. Now to the legal stuff, which is my favorite part of this. It's really hard to understand the U.S. legal justification from where I sit. I was part of a number of these operations where the U.S. was criticized as both a domestic and international law matter for what it had done in places like Libya, for example. But here, on the domestic law side, there's a balance in the Constitution itself between the president, who's the commander-in-chief, and the Congress, who has the power to declare war. If you look at what OLC says about who can do what using their constitutional authorities, OLC says it kind of comes down to whether an operation, a use of force overseas, constitutes war in the constitutional sense. And what does that mean? Well, war is defined by the nature, duration, and scope of a particular operation. Here, you know, I think the administration's justification under that standard would be this was a one-time operation. It was not intended to escalate activities. In fact, there were no U.S. fatalities. You know, on the other side of that ledger, you might say, well, sure, it was a one-time operation, but our forces literally invaded another country with hundreds of aircraft, which resulted in the deaths of military and other security figures from two different countries. And we snagged the acting president of a country. How is that not war in the constitutional sense, one might say? On the international law side, there are basically two reasons that are recognized in international law under the UN Charter for using force overseas. One is where the Security Council has justified and authorized an action, clearly not the case here. And the other is actions taken in self-defense. And self-defense has gotten pretty elastic over the decades. But here, I think the U.S. would say they were acting in self-defense based on the drug trades and the conspiring with terrorists and harboring terrorists that President Maduro was taking on. That's a pretty remarkable stretch of self-defense under how that term has been understood over the decades. So I think on both a domestic law and an international front, the U.S. has been heavily criticized, and I would say understandably so.
One of the things that I have thought about in looking at some of this, the concept of an act of war and the act of sovereignty, is that topographically, we're into new issues where a population in another country could be harmed. Of course, we've seen this with the drug trade, that you can send into the United States something like a pandemic if you did it deliberately. That would kill a lot of people, but would involve no guns, bombs, or anything else. You could also send in a drug that you know a percentage of the population is addicted to that would actually kill that percentage of the population without ever drawing a gun. And I agree it's elastic, but I think in the area of cyberspace, we're going to have to think about a lot of this differently. And these are important broad contours. But I wanted to also mention that on December 5th, Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia introduced a Senate Joint Resolution 98, if you're interested, to direct the removal of United States armed forces from hostilities within or against Venezuela that were not authorized by Congress. I think that thing's still kicking around, but I'm not sure there's any continued military hostilities. And it stated again, the Article 1 of the Constitution, that Congress has the sole power to declare war. So we're not sure how helpful that was, but it was in, you know, sort of the prefatory language. What would the effect of passage of something like that have been on any action against Venezuela of this kind? And does this sort of get back to the tension between Congress can declare war versus the president is commander in chief?
Yeah, it's if this law got passed, would it have an immediate legal effect? I kind of doubt that the executive branch would say, okay, you're right, we'll stand down. I think it's more of a political effect. It's an important one, though, I would say, and would reflect really what the Constitution was about. If the Congress literally directed the president to stop using force, that would be a pretty remarkable statement by a body that really doesn't like to take positions on the use of force overseas. And so I think that would have had a political and a policy effect on the administration. There's, you know, there's a law called the War Powers Resolution that we've talked about, where the law requires the president to report to Congress when he uses force, engages in hostilities overseas. And there's a process by which the Congress could disapprove that use of force or the continued use of force under the War Powers Resolution. And I think what Senator Kaine, who's been a big proponent of increased war powers authorities in the congressional side, he was probably thinking about the War Powers Resolution in drafting this joint resolution, that this could serve as a a resolution of disapproval, if you will, under the War Powers Resolution.
Let's get back to oil and natural resources. And I should say that at the time I was sort of preparing my questions to you, I don't think I understood the extent to which China had infrastructure in the region of concern, particularly since it's not their hemisphere. But I thought one of the things that was interesting was the CEO of Exxon, and I'm not a huge fan of big oil, but I have to say this guy was very interesting to me. He's very circumspect. He discussed at length what their philosophy is from a long-term corporate view. They had a relationship in Venezuela that goes back to the 1940s. I'm wondering if you had an opportunity to see some of what he said and if you had a reaction, if indeed some people feel this was about nothing more than oil. There was an oil contract awarded to a much smaller company that may really not have the capital resources and infrastructure prowess to pull it off. But what were your thoughts when you looked at his response?
I found it very interesting. So the headlines that many of us saw, President Trump has this meeting with all of the leaders of the big three, four, five oil companies in the United States, Exxon, Chevron, et cetera. And the headline coming out of that from the president of Exxon was, Exxon says Venezuela is uninvestable, kind of a slap at the U.S. administration that really wants U.S. oil to come back to Venezuela. I found the comments to be much more nuanced than that, frankly. And as you said, Exxon actually has a long history of being in Venezuela. Back in, I think it was 2007, Exxon was given a choice by the, I think it was the Chavez administration at that point, to take a new deal where they would receive less profit from their investments in Venezuela or to leave. And Exxon and another big oil company, ConocoPhillips, decided to leave. Chevron decided to stay and to take this new deal. Exxon and ConocoPhillips engaged in arbitration. I think Exxon emerged with a $2 billion claim against the government for expropriating its assets, ConocoPhillips an even bigger claim. But they really do have history and some scars from their history. They've never collected on those claims, of course. I think it's understandable why a big company where you need years and years to rebuild production capacity, to make sure, as we would all want it to be, that the field was safe, would be sustainable. Exxon's gotten criticized a lot for environmental issues, and I think they want to make sure they're not setting themselves up for something like that. I can see why a company would take a much kind of longer view than, all right, let's go back in, off to the races. So that was my reaction.
Yeah, and you made a point earlier that I think bears mention here sort of on the heels of this discussion, which is this is not the best oil you could find. It's really dirty. It requires heavy refinement and stages of refinement, much more to refine than oil elsewhere. So I think that the value proposition, you'd have to really factor that in and ask yourself, what would the ROI really be? But let's talk for just a second about what we should be thinking about as we sort of look at all of this, about what has happened and any new relationship with Venezuela, keeping in mind, of course, that the continued government at this time are still Chavistas. You really don't have a huge change of guard. I think what you have is like the head guard's gone, who was surrounded by foreign bodyguards, probably because he didn't trust people in his own government, is my guess, because you mentioned they were Cuban. And if you're a populist Venezuelan, that raises a lot of questions for me. It also gets into an issue that I don't think we've talked about, and we don't have to in this podcast unless you want to, which is the relationship between Venezuela and Cuba is pretty remarkable. But it does seem to me that Cuba depends quite a bit on Venezuela for a lot of its natural resources. But what should we be thinking about? And this can include what you think the implications of any of this are. It might be for Cuba, a country that I know a lot of, certainly not Cuban Americans and people in Florida, they would very much like to see it change. And other people are like, why bother?
Right. As a national security lawyers, I think you and I can, and others follow the podcast, can see all sorts of really interesting questions coming out of this. Some of which we've talked about, like the issues around the U.S. position on use of force as a domestic law and international law matter, and whether that will change the international dialogue on those issues. There's also the issue of Maduro. He is the standing president of Venezuela, at least according to some. Traditionally, if you're the acting head of state, you can't be prosecuted. You have absolute immunity under concepts of sovereign immunity from criminal prosecution. How that issue plays out in Brooklyn court is going to be an interesting one as well. I suspect the U.S. government is going to take the position he's not the actual head of state. There are these issues around claims that Venezuela has, by some reports, over $150 billion in debt in one form or another, bonds, expropriation claims, other creditors, including China, who have claims in Venezuela. How will the whatever the new government looks like deal with those claims? Will there be an international process? What will be the order in which creditors will be satisfied? How does China come into the picture and to some extent Russia in that claims process? And then, as you said, there's issues around Cuba, which has been Venezuela's closest ally probably over the last 30 years, heavily dependent on Venezuelan oil. Revenue, some in the form of oil, from sending Cuban medical professionals and others to Venezuela. How will any change to Venezuela affect Cuba's future? Cuba's proven to be pretty resilient over the last several decades to various U.S. actions that were taken with the design to destabilize the Cuban government. So, is this going to be the one that changes things? We've already heard Marco Rubio and others talk about Cuba being kind of next on the agenda. Lots of really interesting issues to watch here.
I wanted to shift back for a minute to the issue of China's presence in South America. And what I found was sort of an ancillary story that I think probably provides some instruction on how we see it, what happened in Venezuela. But Reuters reported that the U.S. State Department approved a potential sale of $15 billion worth of equipment and services to Peru so it can shift its main naval base to the city of Callao, where it can expand a neighboring seaport. And the move would put the base just a few kilometers from Lima. But the key here would be that it would allow Peru to expand its seaport so that it could compete with a Chinese-built seaport, Chiang Kai, which is 80 kilometers north of Lima. And the U.S. Defense Security Cooperation Agency, which, by the way, I don't even think I knew existed. more on that later. The proposed sale will contribute to the foreign policy objectives of the United States by helping improve the security of an important partner that promotes political stability, peace, and economic progress in South America. A lot of China bases down there. Do you have any reaction to that? And do you feel like that sort of anecdotally relates a little bit to what's happening in Venezuela?
I've been kind of trying to follow China's reaction to the Maduro operation because he was a proponent. He considered himself an ally with China, or at least close to China. They've been critical, but not outspokenly so. They said what you kind of expect them to say in the UN Security Council, violation of sovereignty, et cetera. But given the amount of resources that they've invested in Venezuela and, as you say, in Peru and the region, I'm a little bit more surprised that they haven't been more vocal in kind of objecting to what's going on. And I wonder if China kind of recognizes in some way that if the US position is going to be to double down in the Western Hemisphere, then maybe that kind of justifies China doing the same in its own hemisphere. Who knows? I did find this announcement, though, pretty interesting. Elisa, the port that you mentioned is another port in Peru. So, same country, built and majority owned by a Chinese shipping operator, which is extracting profits, allowing shipping vessels from the Pacific, supposedly cutting the amount of time it takes to offload and unload. And they have an interest there. Just historically, though, you look at what's happened when another country in the Western has gone into the Western Hemisphere and tried to establish shipping operations and port activities. You don't have to look any farther than what the US used to do in Cuba, where we had established any number of shipping operations, and those were all nationalized. So, at some point, all of these issues kind of come back together around each other. I just think that the US position in the Western Hemisphere, how muscular we're going to be, will almost certainly have an influence on how China feels about its own presence here, but also what it plans to do back home.
One of the interesting features, at least of the African port study that was done by AFRICOM, and we had the author of that study on, Paul Nantulia, who's a brilliant guy. One of the observations that he's made is a lot of these Chinese ports can be easily converted to military use. by China for their own vessels. So, I mean, I think they would have commented probably more this week on Venezuela, but they were busy purging generals. I understand that you, it's nothing like getting rid of the head of your military, allegedly, for selling nuclear secrets to the United States. So
Right.
I think that wherever, whatever prison camp he's going to doesn't exist. It's going to be bad.
Wouldn't want to be in their shoes for sure. Yeah.
No, Devil, I wouldn't want to be a Chinese general. I feel like that you would not have a fun day. Anyway, I'm really glad to talk to you. I would like to talk to you again in the future and see where we are, you know, in another year on this, see what it looks like in the rear view, because right now it may look one way, but things tend to change. So anyway, I'm really glad to talk to you tonight. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Lisa.
All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to subscribe to NSLT on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Like and share this episode with a friend. It amplifies our civil discourse content. You are the first to learn. Our next in-person lunch program will be Thursday, March 5th at noon at the Army Navy Club. Now, why should you come? Because you like exciting speakers. We're going to have Jason Rezaian, who is a Washington Post correspondent. I just want to say that he was held in Tehran for 544 days. That's longer than the American hostages were held, which was like 400 something days. He was obviously unjustly imprisoned by Iranian authorities. He'll share his personal experience, his pursuit of legal accountability, and his ongoing advocacy to deter future abuses. He'll be joined in the discussion by David Bowker, a partner at WilmerHale, who helped to represent Jason and win his release from custody. Good lawyer work if you can find it. Excellent. Hold that date, March 5th at noon at the Army Navy Club. If you look in the notes to the cast, we'll have a link and you can sign up to attend. One of the key features of our national security is our actual unity. And when we can't agree, it's important to agree to listen to one another. We do remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than any other, and that's a good thing, even now, no matter what. The writer, producer, and host of NSLT is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the ever lovely, ever amazing, hardworking, and super smart Holly McMahon. Our program director is Antasia Hawkins Blakeney. Social media support comes from Alana Coopersmith. And of course, we're forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, who pursue the good in the interest of national security without regard for politics or party. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.